by the looks of it, the title for our message or for the theme for our service this morning is a little bit changed from what I'm going to be giving here in a minute from Luke 2. This week, as I meditated on the interaction between Jesus as a 12-year-old and his parents, it occurred to me that I did not want to overlook one of the greatest blessings. One of the greatest blessings for a child is for a parent to understand the child, is for a child to feel that their parents really understand them. So it's a great lesson for grandparents or for parents, for a child to grow up in a home knowing that mom and dad or even their grandparents really understand the people they are. It's one of the greatest gifts you can give your children. And it's not easy because it takes work. And there's a lot of things that you've got to drop. Assumptions, expectations about what they should be like and how they should act. So it takes some work, and I want to interact with that because this passage says so much. But it's a great encouragement. And then this morning we're going to have a dessert at the end. I was thinking about putting dessert first. How many of you like to eat dessert first? Do you? And you're still alive. Good. I remember asking Gary's mom, Eleanor Quinn, how did she live to be 98? And she said, I always ate dessert first. So don't let the food people hear that. But I'm going to ask Michelle to give some anecdotal evidence from our own family about this issue. And I think the anecdotal evidence will be worth everything I said. In fact, I just perhaps just sit down right now and give you the dessert without the meal. Don't say amen to that, but we'll reserve, by her request, reserve dessert for last. The gift we give when we understand and really understand our children, it really impacts what life is like inside the home, as well as in many other areas of life. So thank you for listening this morning. Join me for a moment of prayer. Lord, there's one way to look at the rain outside. It may be an inconvenience. We get wet, make it a bad hair day. But on the other hand, when we look at the rain, we are reminded that this is how you treat your enemies. You give them rain. Even though many people do not believe you and shake their fist at you and say that there is no God, yet you, in response, instead of reacting in a knee-jerk way, you give them rain to fill their rivers, to water their lawns and their gardens, and to clear the atmosphere. You are a gracious God. And the rain reminds us that the rain falls on the just and the unjust. Even on the abortionists, you give them rain. You are a kind and gracious and merciful God. You are a great example, and you are our Father. And so today, on this rainy morning, we ask you to do what we cannot do for ourselves, and that's to bring power of your Spirit, to bring life to the dead, and to bring understanding where there is confusion, and to bring hope where there is hopelessness, and to encourage parents, all parents, old and young, the new ones and the ones who have been parents for a long time, a fresh understanding of what it means to really understand our children. You understand us. That's incredible. We are complex people. Thank you that you understand us. And yet guide us and love us for all of our faults and all of our many, many, many failures. So, Lord, lead us like a shepherd today. We need your tender care. We ask for Jesus' sake. How many of you remember, what it was like to be a 12-year-old? Or has that been too long ago? The age of 12 is the age when young folk begin to experience for the first time in their life, more or less, who they really are. They begin to figure out their own identity, apart from their siblings and apart from their parents. We call it puberty, the transition from childhood to adulthood. And girls come at it a little bit earlier, seems to be, guys a little bit later, but sooner or later everybody goes through what we call puberty, or puberty, that transition. What's happening is that the kids begin to pull away from their dad and mom. they begin to pull away. And that's natural. That's not bad. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to begin pulling away to establish who they are and what they want to be in life. So it's not abnormal, although parents sometimes panic, don't they, when they see those kids moving away. It's like, oh no, they don't like me. No, God gave you those kids as assignments, and you have them for a few years. You train them, equip them, disciple them, but the goal is to produce an independent adult who thinks on their own, loves God, and loves their neighbor. But one of the challenges for those first 12 years, and then as those kids move into teens, is the challenge of understanding our kids, really understanding them. It's easy to think that that children are like coming out of a cookie cutter blind. Everybody's the same. Or like their dollar bills being produced by an assembly line up in Congress somewhere, or wherever they make their money. But children are not machines. They're not predictable. They're not made by engineers, thank the Lord. Children are complex, they're unique, and often they don't even understand themselves. But this is normal. This is not surprising. Parents have the unique privilege, as assignments, to understand each child. We raised three sons, and we parented them each differently. There was no cookie-cutter parenting mode. They were different, so we adopted different strategies to raise them. But one of the greatest gifts that we have found, that we have experienced, is if we make efforts to really understand the child, they will thrive, they will flourish, and they will reach heights that God intended them to reach. Now, Jesus' parents failed to understand him. And when we look at the question that we'll see in a moment, that his mother asked him at the age of 12, we realize that his mother misinterpreted Jesus' action as disrespect. She thought Jesus was disrespecting her and her husband Joseph. She thought he had mistreated them. That's the result of not understanding Jesus. That's the result of not understanding his identity and his task for life. But yet no one was closer than Jesus' parents to him. I mean, who else had lived with him for 12 years? And yet in spite of that close relationship, watching him for 12 years, watching him eat, play, grow, they still misunderstood him. So if you feel bad about not understanding your kids, don't worry about it. You're in good company. I mean, God gave Jesus to Joseph and Mary, and they still messed up to some degree. Now, the end of the story is good, as I'll show you a little bit later on. Notice the text in Luke 2:48. We read this last Sunday morning. They searched for Jesus for 3 days, couldn't find him. Of course, that foreshadows after his death when he was gone for 3 days. And another group of people looked for Jesus in the wrong place, a group of women who had been with him the whole time. They went to a graveyard to look for a living person. We all know that's not the thing to do. These parents looked for Jesus among his relatives, among his friends, wrong place to look for Jesus. And when they saw him, they were overwhelmed. He's in the temple, debating with the scholars of the day. And his mom said to him, "Child, why have you treated us like this?" Do you hear the accusation? Do you hear the accusation in the question? Why have you treated us like this? Look. That word look always says, pay attention here. Come on, I need your attention. Look. The old way of translating this is behold. But it's the word look. It means, okay, I'm going to say something really important. Look. Your dad, your father, and I have been anxiously searching for you. Jesus' parents jumped to conclusion. They jumped to a false conclusion. They thought that their son, by what he did, staying behind in the temple and not going home to Nazareth, was an act of mistreatment. It appeared disrespectful. Mary's question to Jesus hints at this accusation. There's two phrases here that I want to unpack just for a brief, you know, from the verse. First is the word overwhelmed, and then secondly, we have been anxiously searching for you. These are two emotional components of their response that made them draw false conclusions and made them accuse it. It's the emotions of the moment that erupt in accusations. First is, they were overwhelmed. What does that mean? Well, often when you hit a word and you don't know really what it means, you go elsewhere in the same book, Luke, and look at how that word is used in another context. Another word, or that same word in another context, sheds light. Let me read one to you here. When the Sabbath came, Jesus began to teach in the synagogue. Many who heard him were overwhelmed. Same word. And here's their questions. Where did he get these ideas? What is this wisdom that has been given to him? What are these miracles that are done through his hands? Do you see the questions and the emotions of being overwhelmed? The people in the synagogue that heard Jesus, heard his wisdom, his incredible knowledge of Scripture, they had no categories for that. They had no categories for Jesus. This Jesus colors outside the lines. He's different. That's not what they expected from this country preacher from Nazareth. He blew away their traditional categories. They were overwhelmed. They were overwhelmed. His parents were overwhelmed. They shouldn't have been, but were. Second phrase, we have been anxiously searching for you. Now, our English translations don't pick up all the nuances of this word. The idea of this word contains panic attack, anxiety, mental pain, emotional anguish. It's natural for parents to be anxious and panicked when a child is missing for 3 days. I mean, if you've lost your child for 1 hour, some people get panicked. But this is 3 days. But in their unstable response, before asking calm questions, before finding out the truth, before finding out the facts from Jesus, before asking him, how is he? How are you doing? Instead of asking those calm, gracious, respectful questions, what happened? They knee-jerked in their emotion and turned to accusation. Mary accused Jesus of personal wrongdoing. Mary interpreted Jesus' actions personally. She took it personally. But what Jesus did, being in the temple, debating with the scholars, was nothing personal against Mary. She thought it was personal. It wasn't. It had everything to do not with her, but with who? With who he was. He was the Son of God. Didn't you know, as he will say in a minute, that I had to be in my Father's house? It's not about her. It's not about Dad. It's about who he was. But she jumped to conclusions, and she assumed the worst about Jesus. Jesus had mistreated them. No, he hadn't. The problem was that they did not understand Jesus. It was a case of parental misunderstanding. They misjudged a 12-year-old. So easy to do, isn't it? It's so easy to misjudge our kids. It's so easy to jump to conclusions and make false accusations when we don't understand our children. Now let's look at his reply. His reply is, why were you looking for me? Do you hear the hint? You should have been looking for me. You should have known where I was. Didn't you know? Didn't you understand that I had to be in my Father's house? You see, Heavenly Father trumped earthly parents. Didn't you know I had to be about my Father's business? But notice what Luke says. But his parents, what? Did not understand the words he said them. Jesus' mom and dad didn't know and didn't understand Jesus. They didn't understand his identity. They didn't understand why he did what they did. And so they accused him of mistreatment. It seems like Mary, when she heard those thoughts, should have said, oh yeah, now I remember. Gabriel came to me and made these astonishing predictions about you. I've forgotten. the angel Gabriel said, you're going to be the son of the Most High God, that I would rule over the house of Jacob, and that kingdom would never end. You would have the throne of David. Now I get it. Thanks for bringing me back to reality, Jesus. She didn't do that. I don't know why. I looked at this text and said, Mary, what's the disconnect? I don't know. It had been 12 years, and there's a lot you forget in 12 years. Good night. I mean, I can forget things in a week, much less 12 years. Maybe it's just bad memory. I don't know. Luke does not say why, so I'm going to not say why. But notice, if she had remembered, there would have been no accusation, no bitterness, no resentment. And did she ever get it, by the way? She did. We'll look at it in a few minutes. We'll see that Mary finally got it and was greatly relieved. All right. This morning I haven't given you an outline, per se. But I will give you some takeaway, and there's a little bit of structure here for this takeaway. I want to divide what we take home this morning from this into past, present, and future. Past, present, and future. It's how we can take this and use it in our life. First, past. Did your parents really understand you? Think about it. Did they make efforts and take the time to really understand the person that you were? Your hopes, your thoughts, your fears, your troubles, and your disappointments. Before they made assumptions about something you did, like what Jesus did by staying in the temple, did they come to you and ask clarifying questions instead of jumping to conclusions that you disrespected them or you offended them? Were they that way with you? Or did they attack you, accuse you, and think that there was some bad thing about what you did? Did they expect you to be like your brother and your sister, and always using you to compare? You're not like your brother. You're not like your sister. Or did they expect you to be like them? And if you weren't like them, did you get their disapproval? Did your parents expect you to vote for the same candidate you did? And if you didn't, they got mad at you? You know what that suggests? That they didn't value you as an individual and didn't value your vote, and that you have to vote like them, which is very self-absorbed. Did they communicate their disapproval and disappointment and anger to you when there was some difference of opinion on an issue? Like if you didn't agree with their view on some issue, political, religious, you know, the Chicago Cubs, Tampa Bay Buccaneers, did they get mad at you and expect you to, you know, keep in step with how they thought and how they believed? Did they try to control you? Control how you felt about issues? Did they use manipulation and guilt trips to make you feel bad about the way you are as an individual? In other words, did they really understand you? Did they understand the damage, for example, that impacted you when they divorced? Or were they so self-absorbed that all they thought about was themselves and left you to swing on the rope? Do they understand what marital discord in the family did to you and the impact it had on you? And at the end of the day, as you think about your parents, what impact did this failure to understand you have on you? Did it produce a healthy child relationship? Did it foster good communication in the home? You know, communication is a two-way street, isn't it? Did it create an atmosphere of grace in your home? Did it create a climate of hope in your home? Did it motivate you as an individual daughter or son to take on huge challenges that otherwise you would have never taken on? That may have appeared too risky to you, too tall, too large, too big, too expensive. Did that atmosphere in your home stifle you, smother you, create fear, lack of respect, or lack of confidence? And here's the kicker. Do you, as that child, the product of that home, love to go home? Love to go home to your parents because it's such a happy, fun place to be? Or do you find excuses not to go back home? Because you don't like to be judged, manipulated, misunderstood, controlled. Now, I've asked these questions and they're not hard to arrive at. The answers are not hard to arrive at. We know it's what I've suggested this morning. It's an unhealthy way to parent. But if you have yourself experienced that growing up, I think we all know that, okay, the past is the past. We need to extend forgiveness, complete forgiveness, and then let's look at the present today. We've looked at the past, now let's look at the present. Let's title this, Understanding Our Children. As I have mentioned, and I'll begin this final section by saying, it's one of the greatest gifts you give to your children. It really is. All parents identify with failure. I do. A sense of failure. I mean, after all, if Jesus' parents failed to understand him, then failure should not be a shock to anybody here. But don't beat yourself up. Don't beat yourself up over it. You're in a ditch. Let's get out. Let's look at what we can do today with our own children and our grandchildren, because the same lessons are applicable. What do we do? Well, first, you need to examine your own marital relationship. How's that doing? Does the husband-wife relationship show that same sense of respect for one another? Or is it one person is continually controlling and manipulating through anger and through jealousy and nitpicking one spouse or the other? Or is there a healthy sense of mutual respect and mutual love and mutual communication? Is the marriage that you're in a tit-for-tat, resentment? You did this, I'm going to do this. You did this to me, I'm going to do the silent treatment. I'm going to not speak to you for a while. Which is nothing more than, of course, pure revenge. Are you easily offended by some little slight? Do you take up other people's offenses? Your kids watch that, and they're a lot smarter than we give them credit for. They know who in the family, who in the marriage, is truly the sacrificial one, the humble one. They don't always have to be the center of attention. It's the parent who's content to do the extra work and not have to be the hero and not have to be the celebrity. So, mom and dad, if you're young or old, give them an example. Let them know that you practice this, trying to understand my partner, my spouse, really understanding them. Secondly, not only mom and dad need to demonstrate that, the second thing is drop unhealthy expectations. Let me illustrate. I had a cousin my age who's now in glory, unexpectedly. She went off to college to a very seriously hyper-fundamentalistic Christian college. The rules for what they were not allowed to do was so much longer than the things they were allowed to do. The school was against everybody and everything. And she went to that college, met her husband, and they went off into the ministry. And their version of Christianity was hyper-fundamentalistic. They had three kids. And none of them adopted that version of Christianity. She expected them to become hyper-fundamentalists. She expected it, desperately wanted it, and none of them bought into it. Now, they're fine Christians. They're wonderful Christians. But they just don't buy that version. And you know what happened to her? Bless her heart. She fell into depression and was on medication for the rest of her life because she couldn't handle what? Her kids not following through on every jot and tittle the way she thought Christians ought to be. It killed her. It killed her. Drop those unhealthy expectations on how they do things, their political choices, their view on religious issues, their friends, their job, their lifestyle. Don't expect them to be carved into your mold. Let them be individuals. Value their individuality. Without conditions, without hooks. You know, judgmentalism is picked up so easy by kids. They pick it up so easy. They pick up racism very, very easy in this day and age. Something else which I would consider a minefield: refuse to get angry and offended and take things personally when they vote differently, when they view things differently. What does that say about you as a person if you get angry at them for not being the way you are? What does that say about you? It means that you're self-absorbed. You're self-absorbed. Let them believe what they believe is true. Let them vote the way they want to vote, and then don't downgrade their vote or get mad and angry that they didn't do it your way. It's sheer disrespect of a person's individuality when we expect people to be the way we are, vote the way we think. Another mind that's in the home is assumptions and perceptions that are unexamined. Think of the conversation between Jesus and his mom and dad if it went this way. Think of what would have happened if this is the way they'd approached it, without assumptions, without assumptions about Jesus' wrongdoing. Think of this. They pull up to Jesus in the temple. They see him going back and forth with the teachers, and they go, man, this is different. So they said, Jesus, wow, we're so happy that you're safe. Why wasn't that the first word out of their mouth? Wouldn't that be the first question a mom or dad would want to ask if a child is missing for 3 days? We're so glad you're safe. You weren't mugged by bandits or killed by zombies. It's so good to see you. Looks like you're having a good time in church with these teachers. They're impressed by you and your answers. We are surprised, but you know, we believe the best about you. We don't want to misjudge you and assume the worst about you. There must be a good explanation as to why you're in church and not with us. We respect you, and we're not gonna just be silent here. We want you to tell us about all this stuff that you know before we jump to conclusions. Now, we admit we were wondering about you. But how about this? How about if we go down the street for some euros and some Colombian coffee? We want to know what you were talking about with these teachers. It's obvious we don't understand you. It's so obvious that we've missed the boat. It's so obvious that this one's on us. We missed all the clues. We missed what you were saying. This is on us, but we want to make it right. Tell us about what you said to so-and-so, to Rabbi so-and-so. Yeah, how about that coffee? Come on, Jesus. Let's go have some coffee before we go home. Now, imagine that kind of interaction in your home. Imagine that kind of interaction in your marriage relationships, where you don't jump to conclusions. You don't have all of these expectations and false assumptions about people, but you have responses that are cradled in grace, believing the best about one another instead of legalistic judgmentalism, free from self-absorption. Imagine that exchange in your home if that was the way you brought yourself up, I mean with your wife, and brought your kids up. Imagine that atmosphere. No judgmentalism, just, hey, tell us more. What happened? We want to know. We're kind of in the dark. Tell me. What kind of a home would that be like? How would kids feel, how would your children and grandchildren feel if they felt like they were respected as individuals who had their own opinions? What would your children grow up to be like? People who respected other people's opinions and took the time to ask instead of what? Jump to conclusions. And finally, there's another IED, another mine in the home that people step on, and it's controlling. Trying to control your spouse, trying to control your kids, trying to control their preferences, their lifestyle, their political choices, their likes and dislikes. What does controlling people communicate to that person? What does that communicate to that person on the receiving end? Controlling communicates that I devalue how you feel and how you vote. It devalues you as a person. It says, my opinion is right and yours is wrong. You're not allowed to vote that way. Like, really? Am I made in your image? Controlling communicates disrespect, self-focus, pride, lack of trust in people. When a person controls his wife or her husband or the children, who do they trust? Who do they trust in life? Themselves and no one else. It's very self-absorbed. And how is it revealed? How do you know if you're a controller? Well, think of the last discussion you had about some controversial issue. And when someone expressed a different opinion about the way you viewed it, how did you respond? You say, oh, I've never thought of that before. Or did you get mad? Did you get angry and get upset that they don't buy into your opinion? That communicates disrespect and control. You can't have that opinion and be a Christian. Really. Controlling is a dead-end road for understanding our children. It stifles, it suffocates, it smothers marriages, and it smothers raising children. It's a mind that will blow up and create damaged relationships. Later in life, I had to draw the line for my parents when I was trying to raise our three sons. I honor my father and my mother, I do, but they were from the old school that you can control the way their children raise their children. And it created a problem in all my brothers' homes until I drew the line in the sand with respect and said, God gave me these children, not to you. They're my responsibility, not yours. Please do not interfere in the way I parent. I drew the line in the sand with respect and the problem cleared up. They never tried to control again. Tough for me to do. Very tough, because I was dealing with my father and mother, who did the best they could, bless their hearts. Third, future. We've looked at past, the way you were raised, present, some of the things we can do to really understand each other, understand our kids, and now tomorrow, the future, just before Michelle comes up with some anecdote. Maybe understanding your kids has not been on the radar. Okay, don't beat yourself up. Don't do that. Use your energy to put it on your radar right now. And get together with your spouse and say, how can we make this work? Make it an equality project. How can we learn to understand our children together? I could have never done it without my wife. Never. She has just so much wisdom. Some of the things I wanted to do, and I'd ask her about it. I said, what's your feedback on this issue? She'd tell me. So I said, you know what? It's a better idea than mine. Most of the time, that's the way it happened. Every once in a while, you know, once in 10,000 years, she might ask me what to do. But that was very rare. Create a climate of grace in your home. Not controlling, not judgmental, not jumping to conclusions, but a climate that believes the best about each other. The best about our kids. That they're trying the best they can to do what's right, and that we give them the benefit of the doubt. And I'll tell you what, in the future, when you have a happy home where they're free to be themselves and free to be individuals with their own opinions and setting a good example for them, I tell you, the fruits that you will enjoy later on in life are sweet. They are. Now, did Mary ever learn to understand Jesus? It was apparent that she didn't at the age of Jesus, 12 years old. Well, I went through Luke, and she's only mentioned one more time. Chapter 8, but the passage doesn't address this issue. And I thought, that's kind of different, because if Luke raises an issue at the beginning, he always answers it at the end. That's not like Luke. And I thought, oh yeah, Luke wrote two books. Yeah, Luke wrote two books. Luke does everything with twos. Sometimes threes. sorry, went to Acts 1, which is volume 2, and I read these words. Now, this is after Jesus has ascended to heaven in full view of the 11 apostles. And after Jesus ascended to heaven, and as they waited for Pentecost to happen, when the Spirit would come, Jesus would pour out the Spirit, this is what Luke records. All these people continued together in prayer with one mind, together with the women, and then he adds this, along with Mary, the mother of Jesus, and his brothers. They weren't there for a prayer meeting to pray to Mary. Who were they there to pray to? Jesus. Mary was praying to who? Jesus. She understood him. She had accepted Jesus as her Lord and Savior and now was praying to him. She got it. Finally. Mary was part of the group. She realized that Jesus, her son, was God's son. Tough for her to do, but give her credit. She did it right. And so can you. Today, put it on your radar. Put it on your radar. Understanding my kids. And it's a gradual process. You won't learn it overnight. We didn't. We're still learning. We're still learning about that with adult children. It's not easy. But God will give you grace to do it. And the results will encourage your heart. Thank you for listening. Now, Michelle, come and provide anecdotal evidence.
Just looking forward to that illustration. I didn't have time to mention to him. I tried to tell him if I'm going to do an illustration about him, but I didn't have time last night. That's my excuse. I was raised by a mom who understands me, and she did it much better than I do, as she did. Has done most things in her life much better than I do. But I think that because I was raised by someone who really understood me and still does, that it was on my radar, as Tim said, that this is important. And so I tried. And like you, if you have more than one child, you know that they're all different. It would be a lot easier if they were all the same, because maybe we could just learn one, you know, and we wouldn't have to focus on understanding different kids. But those of you who have more than one know that somehow, even if you gave birth to all of them, they all are very different, and ours were. So I'm just going to tell what I think is an amusing anecdote. Please laugh, since I'm not really happy about being up here. I got dragged up here by my husband.
One, two, three, laugh.
You don't have to laugh yet.
Thank you.
And if you're a mom or one of the women in the church, forgive me. I'm sure you've heard this before, because this is one of those anecdotes that I tell a lot. You all that have known our family for a while know that we had three boys within a short span of time. Jared was just 5 when Seth was born. And so I think this anecdote happened. Maybe Jared was 6 by then, because Seth was at least able to stand up. I don't know if he was walking yet or not, but he was still a baby, still in the crib, but he was able to stand up. And Tim had gone somewhere out of town. And so I was home all alone, and that's fun when you have 3 kids under 6, right, moms? That's always real fun. And so I was tired. It was the end of the day, and I was putting everybody to bed, and I was ready for everybody to be where? Sleeping, somewhere away from me, just sleeping quietly. And so we, like you guys probably did, we have these little routines of nighttime, you know, it takes a while, you know, pray, kiss 5 times, you know, say this little thing. You know, we all have our little routines that we do with our kids. And our house is small, and the bedrooms are small, and the walls are thin. So you, if you're in those bedrooms, if those of you who have been in our house, they're all 3 bunched up together. You can hear from, you know, one to the next really easily. And we had Jared and Zach were sleeping in twin beds in one bedroom. And they may have still been the old bunk beds that somebody gave us, and I'm not sure if they were still those bunk beds or not. And then Seth was in a crib in the room beside. And so my plan was, okay, let's see how fast I can get these kids to bed, basically. And so I'm going in, take care of Seth first. He's the most compliant. He's the baby. Throw him in that crib. Get him down. Then I go next door and try to get the other two down, right? So I get Seth, usually Mr. Compliant, get him in the crib. You know those old cribs, you lean over, get him, pat him, whatever you do, pray, all by yourself because your husband's not home. Then I went next door, and I think I'm mostly taking care of Zach. And Zach typically goes right to sleep. So I think Zach that night went right to sleep. And so then I'm working on doing that Jared's routine. You know, we're praying, we're kissing, we're whatever we were doing. And we got interrupted because next door I hear Seth yelling. So, you know, I'm a decent mom. I was patient. I went over, "What's wrong, Seth, honey? It's time to go to bed. Lay down. Lean over that crib again. See, moms remember that. Pat, go back." Started the whole routine with Jared again. What do I hear? Tell me what I heard. So I get up the second time. "I'll be right back, Jared." I go back. And, you know, every time I come back, I have to start this whole routine over. Well, the third time, I think it was the third time, I may be giving myself grace. It might have been the first time, but anyway, I think it was the third time that I went back, and that baby was standing up, you know, when they're little and they're holding up on that crib, standing up yelling. And so this time I lay him down, and this time I must have spoken sternly and told him that he was going to lay down, and he was going to sleep, and he was going to like it. And if he didn't like it, he was going to be quiet about it, or something was going to happen to him that would not be pleasant. So very sternly, you moms, you get it. You know what I said, so I won't say it here. And so then I collect myself, go back to Jared, who we are in the middle of kissing and praying, some version of our nighttime thing. And when I had left Jared, he was facing me, facing the door. We were having a wonderful, good time, nighttime moment. When I came back, Jared had turned his back to me, to the door, and was facing the wall. And I walked in, and he heard me, and he did not turn around to me to finish our nighttime routine. And I sat down on the bed. He did not turn around to me. He was obviously not happy with me. And I said, "Jared, are you upset?" And he said, "Yes." And so I had a... I'm going to tell this as if I did a really good thing, because I could have definitely interpreted that in a disrespectful way. And I said, "Well, what is wrong?" And he kind of halfway turned to me, and he said, "You did not need to speak to him that way. He is just a baby." He said it just like that, just slowly, deliberately, like he was speaking to a child who did not know how to take care of a baby. And I looked at him and I said, this is a good illustration, remember? I said, "You are right. I did not need to speak to him that way. And I want to ask you to forgive me, and I'll go talk to Seth now." And I understood, well, two things were going on there. One thing, I obviously felt a little bit convicted because, you know, I'm sure I had a much harsher tone than I needed to have. I was tired. I was frustrated. I was ready for this silly baby to sleep. Don't you hate when a baby will not stop yelling? It's like, stop yelling. But also, the reason Tim wanted me to tell this story today is that the way Jared spoke to me about that, if I had not known him, I could have interpreted it as if he were being disrespectful to me. And he was not, because I understood his heart was truly truly concerned that his baby brother was in there with hurt feelings and had not been treated right and had been treated wrongly. And that was really his heart. And that has continued to be a strong characteristic of him even to this day. He's truly, that was his heart. And so understanding him really helped me in that situation. And so, although I didn't do everything right that night, I did do that one thing right in responding when I was rebuked by my six-year-old son. So that's my story about understanding your children. So I guess you giggled a little bit, so that's good enough. Thank you. I don't want to talk anymore.
As you have rehearsed this story to me many times, or a few times, there's an important element that perhaps needs to be shared. I won't force you to bring it up, but I'll take your words.
Okay.
If I had been in that situation and I had just rebuked her and said, be quiet, you have no right to speak to me that way, I'm the parent, in the face of his plea for his little brother, it would have wounded Jared. It would have wounded him as a little child and smothered him and communicated disrespect to him.
Well, and I think he would have remembered it. He would have remembered that because it would have hurt him, because he would have felt. But as it is, I don't think he remembers it because in his mind, situation taken care of, mom repented and got it taken care of. So I think in his mind, it's not as big a deal as it was to me. But it was a big deal to me in a lot of reasons, like knowing that my children hear the tone of my voice. I didn't say anything abusive to Seth, but moms, we know how you can say it, and I was obviously saying it in a way that his brother took it that it was too harsh. And so anyway, yeah, it would have, and I know, as I said about myself, being raised by a mother who understood me and took my, always gave me the benefit of the doubt when I made a mistake and listened to my reasoning, what the impact it had on me. So I know that was huge.
Thank you for listening this morning. Let's stand as we respond. Would you stand? Worship team, come and let's respond to God's word.